This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Who's doing the cooking in your house today? Chances are a woman or a group of women are in the kitchen chopping the vegetables, stuffing the turkey, and baking the pies. Yes, we know a lot of men do the cooking these days, but it's probably safe to say there are more men watching football than basting the bird. Women have always played the central role in the gathering and preparation of food, a role which can be immensely rewarding at times and look like a life sentence at others. In a new book, Laura Chanone says that along the way, women have shaped the nature of family and society and the nature of food itself. Later in this program, we'll explore the surprising history and revival of perhaps the least respected ethnic diet on the planet, British food. But first, women and food. Can you trace the matrilineal line of your family through food? Call and tell us about the rituals, the creativity, and the drudgery. Or maybe there's a dish passed down from your great-grandmother that's special in your family. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us from our bureau in New York is Laura Chanone. She's the author of 1,000 Years Over a Hot Stove. Welcome and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving, Neil.
In your book, I must say I was surprised to read about this. You tell us the story of Sarah Josepha Hale, whom you call the mother of Thanksgiving. Tell us a little bit about her.
Right. I'm here to tell you that a woman invented Thanksgiving, as we know it anyway. Sarah Josepha Hale was a powerhouse of a woman during the 19th century. She was born in 1788 and had a fairly normal life, got married, had a bunch of kids, and then at 34, something dramatic happened to her. Her husband died when she was actually pregnant with her fifth child, and she had to find a way to earn a living to support these kids. She eventually, after writing a novel, became an editor of a magazine that would become the most popular magazine of the 19th century. It was called Goody's Ladies Magazine, and she presided as the editor-in-chief there for 40 years. So she had a lot of power in this position, and she used it to create a standard holiday that would be celebrated by all the nation, called Thanksgiving, on the last Thursday of November. And it really was not the case until she did this, but it was a long campaign. She began in 1846, this crusade, and went about it in several ways. She published these editorials in her magazine that were rhapsodic about the importance of Thanksgiving. She sent letters to governors, then she turned to presidents. And she also published all kinds of recipes in her magazines that would teach women how to cook turkey, make pumpkin pie, and believe in the power of home and hearth and family to unite the nation.
Hmm.
She really believed in the power of women, and in many ways, she sort of gave this holiday to women.
You could certainly understand how in those times of obviously deep sectional rivalries, it might have been seen in some parts of the country as a Yankee custom.
It was a Yankee custom. Thanksgiving was a holiday of New England manners, and as the Civil War drew nearer, she began to argue that Thanksgiving could be a way to possibly even prevent war, that it would unite the North and the South. And she even wrote a letter to Abraham Lincoln that is available at the Library of Congress. You can even see it on their website, where she implores him to create this national holiday. And in fact, he did on 1863. And that is how we have it today. But it's important to know that this holiday that we celebrate really has so little to do with the Pilgrims and the Wampanoags and whatever might have happened in 1621. Her holiday really was about family and the power of home life, whereas what happened in 1621 was a very different thing.
Well, tell us a little bit about how you came to write this book and why you thought you could tell women's stories, women's history, in fact, through food.
Right. Well, I was not a historian. I wasn't trained as a historian. In fact, I don't think I ever took a history class, but I was a writer. And this, I guess it began about 10 years ago, the idea for this book. I was living in New York City with my husband, and he got a job that required us to move to central New Jersey. And we really didn't want to leave the city, but we decided if we're going, let's do something interesting. And we rented this pre-Civil War farmhouse. And while I was living there, I decided to plant a vegetable garden. And I absolutely fell in love with gardening. And I began to take the vegetables to the kitchen and really see food and cooking in a new light. I did grow up in a family where food was very important, but this was a real turning point for me, this gardening experience. And I began, while I was there, to wonder about the women who had come before me. I was a writer, working at home alone, probably spending too much time alone, and I started looking over my shoulder for the ghosts of the farmhouse women. And I got it in my idea that I could tell my life story through food, and that maybe I could tell every woman's life story through food. This was a naive idea at the time. I had no idea what I was getting into, but that was how the journey began.
And your story starts, I guess, with your great-grandmother.
Right, right. On my mother's side, in many ways, food is and cooking is really passed from mother to daughter to daughter to daughter. And when I look back on my line, I trace my roots back to Croatia. I had a great-grandmother who was basically forced to come here against her will. Her father had come first, as many immigrant men did at the turn of the last century, and he needed a daughter to take care of him. He needed someone to keep house and to cook for him. And he sent home for his, I think it was his favorite daughter, perhaps, and somehow this daughter convinced her mother not to go, but to send the younger one. Mm-hmm. And so my great-grandmother came against her will at 16 and found herself in this country. And I suppose I wondered how many other women came here in a similar way, maybe were forced to and didn't want to.
And ended up as kitchen slaves, I think is one of the words you use.
Yeah, kitchen slaves, exactly. And it kind of goes on from there to my mother, who was a wonderful cook and in many ways my inspiration.
Hmm. Well, let's get some listeners involved. Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's begin with Sarah, who's on the line with us from Minneapolis.
Hello.
Happy Thanksgiving, Sarah.
Happy Thanksgiving to you.
What's your story? Can you tell the story of your matrilineal line through food?
Sure. There are two dishes that I make, one from my mother and one from my grandmother. And because I now live far away from my family, I celebrate with friends. So I take these two dishes, and they're horrible, both of them. They're awful.
It's not the first time I've heard that.
One is my mother's family would take a banana, slice it in half, put mayonnaise on it, and then crumbled peanuts on top of that. It's good, though. I mean, you know, but horrible. Like, to a stranger, horrible. The other one is a Jell-O mold that my grandmother makes that I love, but I don't expect anyone else to ever try. And it involves salad shrimp and tomato soup and lemon Jell-O and celery and onion. And I've been taking it for years to these gatherings of my friends. And every year they eat it. But it's a prank. I don't expect them to. They just do.
Do you have a daughter, Sarah?
No.
If you do, will you teach her how to make these dishes, do you think?
I promise.
But why do you make them, Sarah?
Well, I actually kind of like both of them, but I feel very apologetic about it.
Do you like them because they taste good or because they make you feel connected to your mom and grandma?
Probably both. Mm-hmm. The bananas, I'm not sure, taste good. The Jell-O mold, I think, tastes good. But it's, you know, it's a tradition and it's... It's different from what people do here. You know, I'm a Southerner living in Minnesota, so.
If Elvis drops by, I think he might like that banana dish.
If we fry it.
Yeah, it could be. That might be the secret, Sarah.
I think it is.
Have a happy Thanksgiving and knock back a little Jell-O mold for me.
Thanks, I'll do it.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's try to go with Karen, and Karen's with us from Berkeley, California.
Hi there.
Hi, you're on the air, Karen. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, too.
Hi, Karen.
Hi. So my grandmother used to make amazing matzo balls, and she unfortunately passed away a couple of years ago, but she has definitely left the matzo ball tradition with the whole rest of the family.
And are you able to duplicate whatever it was that made hers amazing?
Well, I'm not sure that I can do them exactly the same, but she always was very proud of the fact that her matzo balls weren't these jawbreakers that everybody else complains about. They had real whole pieces of matzah in them. They had carrots and celery and parsley, and she always would test them every year. She would boil a little bit in in just regular water before she put them in the soup to make sure they didn't fall apart. So my sisters and I try to follow that, but I'm not sure we do it exactly the way she does it.
Go ahead.
I'm curious to know, are the matzahs themselves, did she make them very big? When you say jawbreakers, people complain about that they're too big or too tough. What do you mean by that?
Oh, she, well, hers were, they were pretty much
tender?
Don't resemble the matzo balls you see in other places. They were made, they're, you know, about golf ball size.
That is a little smaller than the grapefruits you get in a lot of delis.
That's right. And the great thing about it is that it didn't matter what Jewish holiday it was, we would always have matzo ball soup.
It's interesting about the size of the matzo ball, because I found an old recipe in the Settlement Cookbook, which is a hallowed Jewish cookbook. It's actually in my book. I reproduced it from the turn of the last century. And the instructions call for matzahs the size of marbles. Hmm. Now, this really, really caught me when you look at what we see today. Like you said, these enormous things. American abundance in this country took so many recipes from the old country and really made them huge and bigger than life, like those matzahs.
Well, Karen, is Thanksgiving a Jewish holiday? You're going to have matzahs today?
We're not doing matzo ball soup on this holiday, but
I hope you enjoy it anyway.
Thank you. You too.
Appreciate it. Laura Chanone, obviously you tell the history of American women in particular in your book Through Food, and of course American women date back to the American Indians and well before the Wampanoags of 1621. You talk about a woman named Buffalo Bird Woman who talks about the importance of corn in her life. There's a passage in your book that I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about her, and then go ahead and read that passage.
Sure. Buffalo Bird Woman was a Hidatsa Indian. She was born about 1839 in an earth lodge in what is present-day North Dakota. The Hidatsas are a Siouan tribe, and they speak a language like the Crow. Anyway, she was a very special woman because she really had a foot in both worlds. She farmed according to the old methods that had been handed down mother to daughter, probably about the same that had been done around 1100 AD. And also, though, during her lifetime, she saw all of this dramatic change. When she was in her, I think it was late 60s, she met an anthropologist and a minister named Gilbert Wilson, and they began this very unlikely friendship. He recognized how much she knew about the old ways, and he wrote everything down and recorded all of her stories in great detail in his book, Buffalo Bird Woman's Garden. And she describes, with a lot of technical knowledge, the farming methods and all the incredible ability they had to grow food, but also about the meaning of food and the spiritual value of food in their lives. So I'll read what she has to say about corn.
I've only left you about a minute to read it. Is it going to take longer than that?
I think it'll work.
Okay, go ahead.
We cared for our corn in those days as we would care for a child, for we Indian people loved our fields as mothers love their children. We thought that the corn plants had souls as children have souls, and that the growing corn liked to hear us sing as children like to hear their mothers sing to them.
Laura Chanone reading something from Buffalo Bird Woman. It's included in her book, 1,000 Years Over a Hot Stove. We'll have more of her stories and yours after we come back from a break. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also email us. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Happy Thanksgiving. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the story of American women and food. What stories do you have? Is there a favorite dish that you just have to make for your family, whether it's special for Thanksgiving or some other day? Our phone number in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Laura Chanone, the author of A Thousand Years Over a Hot Stove. And let's get another listener on the line. This is Ira, who's with us in Denver, Colorado.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Well, my family's cooking traditions were handed down to me. My sister doesn't particularly cook. I'm the one with a child, and at 53 and my mom is 87, I still call her and ask her for recipes. And one of the unusual things is that my mother is blind, and so the recipes, they're not written down anywhere. There, I call her and say, how do I make this? How do I make that? And she cooked all my life, all our lives, the holidays and the traditions, and she just did those, and it was always a little bit exciting because it might taste a little bit different, but she created them nevertheless.
Is there one special thing that you always have to make in her memory on Thanksgiving?
Well, in her honor, actually, recently I cooked a tongue, and I called up and I said, so how do I do this? What do I add? And she told me what to do, and then I, you know, when it was done after hours, I called back and said, how do I make the gravy? And so there are things regularly, but that's one of the special dishes.
Well, Ira, I expect you're not having tongue today.
No, actually, I'm going to roast the chicken and some traditional things, but making the chicken in her honor, yes.
Okay. Happy Thanksgiving to you and to her, would you?
I will. Thanks for your program.
We appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And Laura Chanone, it's interesting. He's talking about oral because his mother is blind, but obviously recipes were always an oral tradition until relatively recently.
Absolutely. You will find when you go back in history that there were aristocratic ladies who kept these lovely handwritten books of recipes. But for the most part, we have to remember that women were not educated until fairly recently and were not literate for the most part. So the rise of the cookbook really tells a very important part of women's history, which is their education and what they did with that education.
And in a way, I guess it's the origins of women's literature.
It is. I actually find the cookbook, the emergence of the cookbook, as a fascinating story. In the beginning, there was this sense, in the beginning of the United States, let's say after the American Revolution, that women needed to be better educated for this grand new country, this grand new venture. And so they were. And as that happened, cookbooks became more popular and technology made it possible to have them reproduced. But cookbooks actually provided really the first vehicle for so many women to put forth their ideas about what they believed in. And so amidst recipes, you'll find in some of these early cookbooks, a writer advocating for women to be educated, maybe fighting against intemperance, putting forth ideas about nutrition or what a home should be like. It's really quite fascinating. There are even cookbooks that advocated for suffrage.
Mm. The first American cookbook, according to your book, was written by Amelia Simmons.
That's right. Poor solitary orphan is how she described herself.
Several patriotic recipes in there.
That's right. Her book was published in 1796. Before that, Americans pretty much relied on the English books that they had carried with them or wherever they came from in the old world. After the Revolution, though, Amelia came out with this book, and in it you really do find this sort of burst of American independence. There are recipes for distinctly American ingredients, and these sort of, proud things like election cake, independence cake, federal pancakes, this sort of thing.
Let's get another listener on the line. Meredith is with us from Salem, Oregon.
Yes, hello. Love your show.
Thank you so much.
We are a bi-coastal interfaith family. And every Thanksgiving, we have a little clash of cultures here because my husband's family makes scalloped oysters, which I think are absolutely disgusting. And I make chopped chicken liver in my grandmother's honor, which his family think is disgusting. So our kitchen always smells very interesting, but it's a really nice tradition that we started as I'm 3,000 miles away from family this Thanksgiving.
Oh, that's so nice. And how does the kitchen smell?
Disgusting.
You don't make these any other day of the year, do you?
Absolutely not. I don't even allow oysters in my house any other day of the year, but it's a good Thanksgiving tradition.
And tradition sometimes is more important than how even that tastes on the palate.
Absolutely.
Meredith, thanks very much for the call. Happy Thanksgiving.
You too. Bye-bye.
email from Natalie Garcia in Reno, Nevada. My mother passed away 5 years ago, she wrote. Whenever I feel homesick and begin to miss her, I make a dish that she would make on at least a weekly basis. She was from Holland and would boil potatoes, barley, sauerkraut, and spare ribs together and mash them in the end with lots of salt and pepper, served with her favorite mustard. I almost feel her presence since she absolutely delighted in fixing this special meal for us.
Wow. That's beautiful.
It is. So many things like that recall. I think everybody has that special meal. The corned beef and cabbage in my family, maybe, but that recalls early family memories.
Yeah, food gives us an opportunity to feel a real connectedness with the past. If we want to, if you open yourself up to it, and if you really want to get into it, you can become aware that food offers us a certain spiritual connection. And I think sometimes when we're remembering people who are gone and we make their food, there is that spiritual connection there. We sense that we're a part of the fabric of everything, the past, the future. And you can even take it further and become aware of the connection that we have to the land and the earth, and the water that gives us our food. So I think that when we have a lot of these emotions and connect memory to food, there's a reason for it. There really is a lot going on there.
Our next caller is Dina, and she's with us from Berkeley, California.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm enjoying your show. I just wanted to say that we get together during Thanksgiving, and of course, being an Iranian American, there's always an Iranian hint to our food. There's rice with barberries, and since we're mostly a pomegranate fan, there's definitely something with pomegranate, either a pomegranate soup or pomegranate seed in a salad, and definitely for decoration. And it reminds us all of the good times that we had in the past.
Is there an equivalent to Thanksgiving, some sort of fall harvest feast in the Iranian tradition?
There is, but it's much earlier. It's actually the first day of fall, which is usually September 21st.
And I would be surprised, Laura Shannon, if there was a society almost anywhere on the planet that didn't have some sort of a harvest festival.
They're from everywhere. Everyone has one. Some sort of moment to give gratitude, whether it's for the sometimes they're specific, strawberry festivals. We still have them here, really. There are corn festivals, all kinds of tomato festivals. Yes, it's absolutely universal. But, just to speak to that caller, it's really interesting how for immigrants, Thanksgiving is such a rite of passage. To cook that first turkey really means you're American in many ways. But what is wonderful today is that people, often immigrants, will keep, they'll have the turkey in the middle of the table, but they'll surround it with these side dishes
that
speak to them about where they're from. Hmm. And it creates a connectedness between the past and the present.
Dina, you're making a turkey as well as those other dishes today?
Well, actually, my mom is, and she is stuffing it with rice with barberry. So I'm making some kind of pomegranate jello.
Thanks very much, and I hope you enjoy it.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Happy Thanksgiving. Let's go to, this is Felice in Hoboken, New Jersey.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Laura, I wanted to say that I really, really enjoyed your book, and I just wanted to ask you a question first. I was wondering, in your research, specifically, what ethnic traditions you found most fascinating or compelling?
Well, it's hard to say, to give preference to anyone. I would say that just in general, immigrants really fascinated me because there is this emotional connection to food. And you see it in so many different immigrant cultures. It emerges in similar but different ways. I do find that the Jewish traditions of Kasruth, kosher cooking, was very compelling to me because when a woman is cooking food, she's really like a custodian for the spiritual and the religion, the spiritual and religious aspects of life. And I would say that the natives were very compelling for the same reason. Of course, I love Italians because I have some Italian as well. I just generally think that sense of continuity. Immigrants come here, and most often they come from places that are slower paced, more rural, and food has been less taken over by technology. So I would have to say that.
Great. And, I'm from an Italian Irish family. We are traditionally much more Italian in our cooking, and today I made an eggplant caponata, which is pretty much a staple for our Thanksgiving here.
I have to say, I'm from the Irish ethnic background, Felice, and if you had to pick one to go with, I think you made the right choice.
Thank you.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Here's an email we got. This from Brooke. The first time I had Thanksgiving with my husband's family, I wanted to help his grandmother in the kitchen. I watched her take the beautifully brown bird out of the oven, take out the dressing, and to my horror, pitch it. She claimed that the dressing in the bird was to absorb the fat and season the bird. We ate some crunchy stuff that she baked in a Pyrex dish. So, so I guess it's not only bringing immigrants being made American through cooking their first turkey. It's always, as you go into a new family, women going into a new family, it brings them into that particular kitchen as well.
Right. It can be a source of anguish even.
Now, the politics has always been connected with food as well, especially in America.
Yeah, you really can't get away from the political aspects of food. I mean, I don't even know where to begin, from the time that the Indians, you know, lost their land to industrialism. And right now we face so many questions about food politics with pesticides and what technology has done to the food supplies. It's really an ongoing thread. Women have used food actually to become involved politically in their world. They sometimes would do it wearing like a lady's cloak, but they would get involved. For example, at the end of the 19th century, women who became extremely involved in charities and ladies' leagues and do-good societies. This was a very big thing going on at that time. Published charitable cookbooks that raised a lot of money for the causes and political beliefs that they cared about. So that's one way.
And then, of course, more modern times, you get to the lunch counter sit-ins of the civil rights movement in the 60s.
Right, right. You know, food really does touch the idea of when we get a chance to eat at the table. It has a symbolic essence to it, and definitely during the civil rights movement that was there. And then again, of course, there was someone like Frances Lappé in the 1970s who wrote that book Diet for a Smaller Planet, and she basically advocated that we should become vegetarians to help save the world from hunger. So it really, it just runs through again and again.
Now, you called your book, in your book, Chapter 10, Apron Strings, Did She Really Cut Them? What did you mean by that question?
This is the ongoing question of do we still want to cook or don't we? And I have to say I lost sleep over this question as to how I would end the book after writing this glorious history of women that went through industrialism and immigration and wars and all this. I came down to today and I just would feel so confused. You know, on the one hand, you read about this glorious foodie culture on what you see on the Food Network, these beautiful magazines that are out. You go into the food store, you see all these wonderful foods we never used to have, from mangoes to kiwis to, it's all out there. But on the other hand, we have no time, and women are working. And so this really is a very difficult question, one that I don't think we've fully resolved, to tell you the truth. I finally found ways to resolve it in my life, but as a culture, I think that women feel some anguish over this, you know, wanting to cook, having no time.
Laura Chanone, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, it was wonderful. Thanks for having me, and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. Laura Chanone is the author of 1,000 Years Over a Hot Stove, and she joined us from our bureau in New York. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.